This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We said we'd bring you a program today about the new Alliance Party, but we've postponed that until the next edition of Fresh Air. My guest, Jessica Tuckman Matthews, was described in the New York Times Magazine as part of a new breed of experts with the interdisciplinary background necessary to shape a new agenda for the post-Cold War world. Matthews is vice president of the World Resources Institute in Washington, D.C., which she helped found in 1982. She also writes a column about environmental issues for The Washington Post. She was on the staff of the National Security Council during the Carter administration. She worked on nuclear proliferation, arms sale policy, and human rights. So she's an expert in national security and the environment, two issues which have come together.
I see them having come together in what for me personally is a very happy way, since it brought together two interests, but which more importantly globally is that environment has become one of the probably the most powerful of a set of forces, technological development and economic trends being the other two, that are changing the nature of national sovereignty and therefore the independence of states and therefore the way states can protect their national security in the most profound way really since nation states developed hundreds of years ago.
When you talk about the changes to national sovereignty today, you're talking about the end of the Cold War, the dissolution of the Soviet Union, the civil wars around the country we're seeing now?
Well, I'm talking about something, I think, more profound and also more pervasive, and that is that borders are coming to mean less for many reasons. The first, of course, is technology. That is, the fax machine was the great weapon of the Tiananmen Square uprising, and the television stations were the first target of the Soviet coup last summer. Borders are no longer the barriers between peoples that they once were. Secondly, the economic trends, not only does capital move around the world and resources freely, but even labor is moving now. I mean, you're in my credit card account may be toted up this month in the Philippines or in Northern Ireland. But finally, also the environmental trends don't take any notice of national borders. So for all those reasons, nations can no longer assure their own security, their own well-being, either economically or even in terms of their physical existence, through military force or by protecting a line on a map.
Now, how does this relate to the environment? You're saying that environmental issues can't be seen as domestic issues anymore.
That's right. And, you know, traditionally we have viewed foreign policy and domestic issues as totally separate. And inside the government, we have completely separate bureaucracies that deal with those, too. But in fact, those set of issues that you can call unequivocally domestic concerns are themselves an endangered species. I mean, for example, energy policy, which we think of as a domestic issue, is very much, to other countries, an international concern because the U.S. uses about a quarter of all the fossil fuels that are used, consumed on the globe, and contributes that much to the emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. So they are emphatically not solely a domestic matter, say, to the Europeans, looking at our emissions and our energy use. And the same is true everywhere. The line between domestic and foreign policy has become so blurred that in many cases it's not worth drawing anymore.
Do you think that countries have caught up with the international aspects of environmentalism? Do you think that there are ways to address how one country's pollution affects the rest of the world or how one country's pillaging of resources affects the rest of the world?
Well, it's hard to answer that because I think it's a very mixed picture. I mean, for example, on the positive side of the ledger, we had a few years ago the Montreal Treaty, which is going to phase out the use of chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, the chemicals that destroy the stratospheric ozone layer. That treaty was a rather unprecedented example of international cooperation. The countries got together to do something on an international level that would be very difficult to do even on a domestic level. That is, they agreed to get rid of a very useful class of chemicals in the face of substantial scientific uncertainty and without demonstrated evidence of damage, only the expectation of future damage. Now, that really was quite an amazing achievement. Yet in other ways, I think the international system is way behind either the needs or the realities of international cooperation. So it's very much a mixed picture.
Do you see areas where environmental interests conflict with political interests or trade interests and environmental interests are losing out?
Well, there are many areas where they, where environmental and political interests overlap. Often the conflicts are less real than sometimes they seem. For example, water is a key issue in the Middle East, and cooperation, while terribly difficult to achieve, is also one of the big payoffs that all the countries in the region recognize might come from an international peace agreement in the region. Right now, all the countries in the Middle East are in a water deficit. That is, they use all the water that they get every year, and they're mining their underground water, which they can only use once and then will be gone. There is more water in the region, and there is enough water probably for many, many decades if it can be cooperatively developed and shared, but that depends on peace. So it's often the conflicts are more apparent than real.
This is a period in which there's some redesigning at the CIA in this post-Cold World era.
Right.
And there was recently a national security directive issued by President Bush. And in that, he said that he envisions reshaping of the CIA to include greater focus on the shortage of natural resources, on global health problems. He even sent a copy of this directive to the Environmental Protection Agency. I'm wondering if you've been thinking about how the CIA might be used for better or worse in the future in ways related to environmental issues.
Well, the first and the most obvious and most important way is to mine the intelligence data that we already have for information that could be quite important to scientific understanding. I'll give you one key example. For years and years, decades, we've been collecting data on the thickness of Arctic sea ice because it's terribly important for our strategic submarines that hang around up there and that need to know how thick it is at all times and where. It turns out that that data is enormously important for understanding the progress of global warming and could give us a much longer baseline trend than we now have from satellite measurements. So it simply needs to be declassified and made available in a way that doesn't compromise security interests. So mining the existing data is the first and most urgent task. The next one is to figure out how intelligence collection could be used with a very modest additional cost to get new data. In other words, you've got a satellite that's up there anyway, say, for monitoring arms transfers or whatever, arms developments. Could it not, or how could it be used at a very small incremental additional cost to collect environmentally useful data? Then there is a third set of possibilities of using intelligence collection on the ground to collect environmental information and perhaps to provide early warning systems of famine, of climate change, et cetera. There, I think we don't know quite yet. I haven't explored fully whether the CIA or the national intelligence agencies could do that either cost-effectively or appropriately for an agency which is, after all, intended to be secret. I think these issues haven't been well explored and need to be looked at. The same holds true, by the way, for the question of using the CIA to collect economic intelligence, as is being discussed. These are really not obviously appropriate functions for a secret agency, and we need to figure out how compatible they really are.
Are you worried at all about damaging things the CIA could do if it decides to get more involved with the environment?
Well, I certainly think there are lots of things that might be done much less expensively outside the intelligence agency than inside. There could be money wasted. And I think that there is at least a theoretical concern that information meant for the mutual benefit of all mankind that might be in a way tainted if it's collected by, at least for some governments, if it's collected by national intelligence agencies. So I think there are issues that need looking at, yes.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jessica Matthews, and she's vice president of the World Resources Institute based in Washington, D.C. She's also a columnist for The Washington Post, where she writes about the environment and other global issues. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jessica Matthews, vice president of the World Resources Institute. When you look around the world and look at environmental issues, which countries would you say are doing the most damage to the global environment now?
Well, I'd say we have to put, although I hate to do it, but I think an honest answer is that one has to put the U.S. first because of its gargantuan emissions of greenhouse gases. We, as I mentioned earlier, we do account for a full 25% of all the carbon dioxide that comes from burning of fossil fuels. And in many respects, I think greenhouse warming is probably the greatest long-term environmental threat that we face as a species, as a planet. There are many other countries that are doing far greater damage to their own environments or to regional environments. You have a situation, for example, like Haiti. Right now we're facing this enormous influx of Haitian boat people here in the U.S. And we think of it as a function of both of poverty and of the horrible political crisis in Haiti that stems from the brutality of the Duvaliers. But in fact, the root cause in Haiti is deforestation and the consequent soil erosion on these steep slopes, and the fact that people, where that erosion has happened and there is virtually no topsoil left, it's impossible to grow food on bare rock. And that's what's forcing people out of the hills, into the cities, and ultimately into the boats. And until there is a solution to that crisis, there will not be a lasting solution to the political crisis. And I suppose one also needs to mention on the list of worsts is the situation in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, where I don't think we've even begun yet to see more than the tip of the iceberg of the really appalling environmental abuse that has gone on there and the horrible economic cost that those societies and those people will pay because of that level of pollution and land degradation over the coming years.
When you look at the fledgling attempts to have international agreements on environmental issues, do you see certain countries that are doing their best to block solutions?
Well, the U.S. was the great leader in the Montreal Treaty on chlorofluorocarbons. We hammered away at it for years and years and years and were ultimately successful and really was a great achievement. Right now, we've kind of reversed position on the efforts to negotiate a greenhouse treaty, and we're in the caboose rather than the driver's seat and being one of a very few nations that is attempting to slow progress in that direction. I'd say the leaders right now, in terms of international negotiations, are probably the Europeans, and I think that's partly because that the birth of the European community has forced the European nations among themselves into an extraordinary amount of international cooperation. I mean, they are doing things among 12 nations that we are unable to do even at the federal level, getting agreement on waste policies, getting agreement on a national, in our case, national, in their case, international energy policies. It took us a decade to get agreement on a new Clean Air Act that involved balancing the interests of Ohio and Vermont so we could control acid rain. It took them much less to balance the interests of 12 different nations in an international treaty to control acid rain. So they are getting into the habit, so to speak. They are learning the habits of regional governance and of international cooperation and treaty building and are ready to move, I think, much more aggressively than we right now in addressing some of these other issues.
For years, environmentalists have been warning us that it will soon be too late to reverse the terrible trends that we've set in motion. Do you have a time clock that you operate by where you say we've got to fix this by a certain date or else?
I think it depends very much what one is talking about. I am basically very optimistic about our ability to make the planet livable basically forever. but it requires huge changes. And the question will be, I think not, I guess I'm optimistic even to say that the question is not even whether, but when. and then the question becomes, how much degradation will we endure, some of it irreversible degradation, before we see what's happening and mobilize the political will to act? I think that the most urgent areas are two. First, population growth. Because of the momentum of population, it is important to act sooner rather than later. And let me illustrate it this way. The UN projects that ultimately global population will stabilize either at about 9 billion at the very lowest estimate or at 14 billion. Now, the range there from 9 to 14 of 5 billion people is as much as are now living on the planet. So that says both how important it is to act and how important it is to act soon if we want to come anywhere near the 9 billion end of that range rather than 14. And the other area that I think is most urgent is in slowing emissions of greenhouse gases, because climate change, if we don't know what the outcome will be, but if it is what the scientific consensus now suggests, it could be pretty awful. And the more that we can do now to slow emissions at low cost, the less risk we run.
If you don't mind, I'd like to ask you a couple of things about yourself. Your mother was the historian Barbara Tuchman, who I'm sure a lot of our listeners have read books by. Can you describe the intellectual atmosphere in your house when you were growing up?
It was, I think, both my mother and my father were people whose great joys came from reading and from learning and from arguing about things. It was, in that sense, I guess, certainly an intellectual household. And both of them shared a very deep interest in kind of the human story and history. And it was, I think, an environment that, or the message that my sisters and I got was that you were likely to enjoy your life most if you made the most of it, and that was principally a function of how much education you could pack in.
How did you find your niche? How did you figure out that you were interested in global issues and the environment and national security?
Not very directly. My first love was science, and I got a PhD in molecular biology. But I'd always had this interest in government as well. My mother's family had been very active in government. Her uncle had been Secretary of the Treasury for 12 years under President Roosevelt, and her cousin, my second cousin, Robert Morgenthau, is Attorney General of New York, and there was a long history of government service in the family. And I just was always drawn to that. So in my last year as a, right after I finished my PhD in lab, I thought, well, I'd take a year off and go as a Congressional Science Fellow to Washington. This was a program for 1 year to act as a science advisor in Congress. And I never got back to the lab. And I kind of went from there. My interest began more in dealing with the environment and with scientific and technological interests. And then during the Carter administration, I worked in the White House on the National Security Council and dealing with global issues. And so I've had the very really wonderful luck to have these two interests, foreign policy and the environment and resources, now come together and converge. So it's really been very lucky.
I just have one last question, and this gets back to your parents again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of parents feel that they want their kids to grow up smart and educated, and they go about educating their children in a very self-conscious way where everything's a lesson.
Yeah.
About the future. Did your parents do that?
No. No. And we certainly never had sort of that kind of pushing at home. The kinds of crazy, at least I think, you know, pushing of young children with flashcards and extra lessons and this, that, and the other that you often see now, teach them to read at 2 or 3 and teach them French right away and all that stuff. We never had that. And we never had, they certainly never, for example, inserted themselves into our homework or even really offered to help. But there was, a very strong unstated, which they managed to convey somehow, learning was terribly important, and that the only thing they cared about, but that which they really expected, was that you did your best. And that was very explicit. And when one thinks about it, is really quite a pretty stringent standard, right?
They used
to say, "Oh, I don't care what grade you get, so long as you do your best on everything." And I realized I took that sort of for granted. But I realized looking back on it, that really is a big push. and that was the message. That was the key message.
Yeah, doing your best is a lot of work.
Yeah, you were expected to do your best on everything. And less than that was a disappointment. But it wasn't measured against anybody else or anything else or any other standard. But I guess there was also the perhaps implicit message that if you did your best, it would be good enough.
Well, Jessica Matthews, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks.
Okie doke.
Jessica Tuckman Matthews is vice president of the World Resources Institute in Washington, D.C., and a columnist for The Washington Post. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.